Mr. Arthur, Reel 4. We were talking about your time on the HMS Anemone, and we were looking at a typical convoy. And what about, you know, when you got there, the trip back? How was that organised? What difference was it?
Well, the trip back was always a bit like backing a horse race when if your bet comes in, you get sunk. You know, you are never quite sure if you're going to be the unlucky one to draw the hairy end. And so until you get to sea, you don't know what's going on. You don't know where you're going. But you know you've got to rendezvous at a particular point and pick up a convoy. And what will have happened on the way, or before you, there's the other convoy would have come in, and you maybe have talked to some of your shipmates, and you say, what was it like out there? They say, cool, blimey, they've got something new, you know, whoa, better not, you know, they're putting the wind up you. And there was always something, acoustic torpedoes, all sorts of funny things were brought out. But going back, it was much the same as... It was rather more important because the going back was the most important part of your job, because instead of empty ships, these were full ones, and these were when they went up, you did actually notice them going up, an ammunition ship going up. I've only seen it happen once, but you can see it a long way away, quite spectacular, and of course it was food as much as anything else that was coming across, and you saw, as I said before, we saw cheeses floating past, and you got an idea of what convoys were all about. They were, suddenly you got the message that, you know, your job was really quite useful. You weren't just there to kill submarines, you were there to get the food back.
How tired would you get on a journey, on a convoy? You know, you were...
Tired?
Yes, you had this relentless watch-keeping and...
Yes, well, the thing is that when you got back, you knew that some of you would be going on leave. They would be about 10 days in harbour, which half the ship's company would be allowed to go home for perhaps a week on leave. So there was something to look forward to. And also, when you went back, you had, on leave, you had your rabbits. Rabbits was the name given to... stuff you brought back from Newfoundland or from Halifax. For example, when I went into Argentina once, I went over to the local Chinese store and bought a whole lot of bananas, and I carried these bananas back in the cable locker, which was the coolest place on board. And these are the first bananas that my friends had seen, family had seen, for a long, long time, because they weren't normally imported. So there was always that little bit of excitement going back, looking forward to going home. But you had to get home first, and you knew that the submarines would be out in force, much more so on the homeward-bound convoys than on the outward-bound ones. And so you were very much on your toes. Now, when you got finally into harbour, when you got alongside that berth, when you went down the River Foyle again. And there was a funny thing, because you'd last seen the Foyle perhaps, 6 weeks before. Might have been 5 or 6 weeks before. And you suddenly saw a change from spring. It was summer. You saw a total change in the Loch Foyle. It was extraordinary. And then you went down, you went alongside, and half the ship's company went almost immediately off on leave. And the rest of them got blind drunk, because there was no debriefing. And those who bottled their tots on the way back went out. Many of them were out for a day, absolute paralytic, because it was that tension. And don't forget, when you got back, the first thing you did was to take your clothes off. And you could have had your seaboot stockings on for a fortnight and never having taken them off. And I still remember taking mine off and the smell of ammonia, strong ammonia. which was a decomposition product of the sweat, the urea, and it came into ammonia. So it was ammonia that came up. And when you were not painting ship, you were doing your scrubbing your bedding, cleaning your bedding, washing, doing your own personal domestic chores. You did all your own washing. There was no laundry.
How would you do the washing? I mean, is it the bucket method?
Bucket and soap and a board you scrubbed it on. One of the things you washed as hard as you could was your blue collar, because the more you washed it, the paler it got, and the paler it was, the more you went to sea, and, you know, old salt. You didn't just have to sort of have a rolling gait, you had to have a pale blue collar as well. And you could always tell the ones who had only just come to sea, because their white stripes in the blue collar were pale blue, which they hadn't managed to do it properly. So there was a way of dealing with that. Put salt in the water, I think. You did salt water instead of fresh water. So if you did the salt water, you're a sailor, and the white came white. But that's as be as it may.
Would you get blind drunk when you got back?
No, I didn't. No, not everybody. But it was very, very difficult to wind down. I don't know what it is with any tension. After an examination, for example, you're tense, and you learn a way to wind down one way or the other. Go and talk to old friends or whatever.
Were you scared? How did you feel in yourself about it? Did it prey on your nerves?
You weren't scared as such. You just were philosophically resigned to the fact that you might not get back. Didn't think it was highly likely, but there was the chance always there. And I would say, when you were sitting quietly on your own, off watch, and you heard the water rushing past the steelwork next to you, you suddenly thought, but there's a great feeling of, if you haven't been hit, of being safe on board. But I suspect if you've ever gone down in a ship that you never feel quite as safe again. But unfortunately, I was only over the side once, and that was enough. And the water was so bloody cold.
That's later, though, I presume.
No, this was in Argentia Harbour. One of the sea boats had gone over the side and got a hole in it. We had to go and get into the water to get it out again. And I suddenly realised what it would be like if you had to go over the side and not go back again. Bloody cold. Freezing. No. They reckon in the Arctic, you 4 minutes you're dead from the cold. That was the folklore. But anyway, I got back. The last time I got back, I was told there's a draft chit for you. You would report.
How many did you go on, would you say?
About four or five, I think.
How long were you with the ship, the Corbett?
About best part of a year.
So round about from January 42 to January 43?
No, it'd be December 40. The best part of that 1 year.
So December 42.
December 42.
And how come you left this? Oh, before we leave, what you said it was a happy ship. Could you say to me what made it a happy ship, do you think? And what was a happy ship, you know, as opposed to an unhappy ship? Why was that Corvette happy?
One, the officers were very efficient. They weren't trying to impress anybody. They were competent. And respected because of it. And two, there was a mixture on board from Glaswegian bank clerks to Hebridean fishermen who could barely speak English. Gaelic was their native language. And there was a total mixture of people. But there was this feeling you had that you were in good hands, because there were enough leading seamen and petty officers who knew what they were doing, and you felt you had confidence in them. And the rest of you there were very few people who didn't fit in. You were such a tight unit that people just did fit. You couldn't be the odd man out. There was no room for you. There was nowhere to go and hide.
Did they get rid of malcontents or troublemakers?
No.
Or there just weren't any?
There weren't any. Not on Anemone, there weren't. I don't know why. There were, of course, the odd people had up for being drunk, and that was understandable some way. But there was a very little indiscipline. People did what they were told without having been told twice. You know, your detail ought to do that. You did it. You didn't shirk. Because if you shirk, somebody else had to do it, one of your messmates. So, you know, the messmates kept you at it.
Now, how did the posting come about at the end of...
The drafting.
Drafting, yeah.
Oh, there was a draft ship waiting for me. And I was told to get my bag and hammock, take a week's leave and then report to King Alfred.
Now, how did you feel about that? That's what you'd wanted, wasn't it?
That's what I wanted. I felt very pleased. I wasn't pleased to leave the ship. I'm pleased to take on more responsibility, I think. There was one thing I didn't have on board Anemone, was responsibility. And I suppose that's really what... it's the way people are made, isn't it? Some people want it, some people don't. A lot of people on there would have been just as good as I at the job, but they didn't want the responsibility. They preferred to have a life on board Anemone with their messmates doing a job as a family. That's the real point. A happy ship is a happy family. And, you know, where everybody making allowances for the other and looking after each other.
So you got the draft in December 42.
Yep.
To King Alfred.
King Alfred.
Did they have a name at the centre? Was that at Hove, the swimming bath?
Well,
or was it
we
else?
First of all went to K.A. We first of all went to Modon, which is a prep school. We were there for a fortnight, living in digs.
What did you do there?
Well, it was basically to vet us, to see if we were going to waste the Navy's time if they took us any further. For example, if you wet your bed, you were straight out. That was the story. There were people, apparently, who did. I don't know. They looked at you and saw, are there any people we can weed out at this stage? They taught you semaphore, they taught you a bit of this and a bit of that, but most of the time you were acclimatising yourself to being away from your mess deck.
And what proportion would you say were weeded out?
Oh, one or two people, that was all.
Out of?
Yes, you didn't notice them when they went. They were quietly sent back to their ships. There were people who got drunk, perhaps, or people who couldn't behave when they went ashore. You were being watched very, very carefully all the time and never knew it. Very sensible. But from there, you were then reported to Modon, and you were taken by bus to Lancing College, which is known as KAL, King Alfred Lancing, KA brackets L. And there you spent about 3 months, fairly rigorous training in all aspects of seamanship, ship handling, torpedoes, gunnery, all the things that you needed to know.
Now, was this any further on than what you'd already received?
Well, I'd already see that in 1939, some of it, but it was at a much higher level. Also, developing leadership.
Now, how do you develop?
I don't know.
How did they try and do it, then?
They gave you jobs to do. For example, we had to go out from the college and try, armed with thunder flashes and so on, to storm the college from a different angle and not get caught. We had sort of, almost you might say, OTC, army-type manoeuvres, and to see who shaped up. there was that sort of thing. We also had a splendid time with ice cream vendors, tricycles. They used to sell ice cream, Wall's ice cream, from a box on two wheels with a chap behind on a pedal, so you're pedalling this box. And there'd be two of you, one sitting in the box, one pedalling, and the one sitting in the box would be navigating, and the one pedalling would be blindfold. And so you would be having a taking bearings on different things and altering courses and plotting. It was really, you weren't going very fast, it was the best that they could do, and it worked quite well. But it was pretty hectic, and there was a great deal of square bashing again. And I remember, again, they were watching out. There was a trap, it was said, this is just folklore, a trap laid for the young cadet rating, as you were then known. You had a white band instead of a cap tally, and you were a cadet rating. And the first fortnight you were at Lancing, you all messed in the main school refectory, but you were up in the balcony, and there were two very attractive blonde waitresses. All the catering was done by the, because Brighton had all the catering facilities at peacetime, and they didn't have any visitors, so we had all the girls from the, all the waitresses there were attending upon us sailors. And we had these very attractive young ladies up on the first balcony, and it was said that you watch it, mate, because just one, lay one finger on those, and you're back on your ship. They're all trained to report back on any behaviour that they think is not going to go down well. That may have been true, maybe not true, but certainly they were left alone. And then we went. We were living in the dormitories, the school dormitories, and so on. It was quite a busy, exciting time. We didn't get much time to go ashore. There was a lot to learn, a great deal to learn. Seamanship, ship handling, navigation particularly. Navigation is, which meant again, spherical trigonometry, the whole business of pilotage, which is using pilotage when you're near the shore, and you've got landmarks. Navigation is basically with a sextant and using stars and things and so on, which was very interesting. Anyway, from there we went to Hove, K-A-H, where we went to the sports complex it is now. In those days it was a restaurant with garages underneath, and we slung our hammocks again in these garages. And next to us was the original King Alfred, which was the RNVR peacetime establishment, a tiny little place. And then from there we went to Shoreham Harbour, marched to Shoreham Harbour. We had practical ship handling in Shoreham Harbour on various odd vessels that they dug out for us.
And how did you find that?
Oh, it was quite fun. But it was then, while we were at King Alfred there, we got measured for our uniforms. That's where we changed from bell bottoms to gold buttons. That we passed out as temporary acting sub lieutenants.
And what did you? Where did you get the uniforms from? Was it from Gives?
Oh, of course. I think I've still got an account with Gives, but I haven't been able to afford to use it for a long time. But it's not the same. Gives and Hawkes isn't the same. Gives is a marvellous firm.
What service did they offer you then as a young sub-lieutenant? I mean, what would they do to fit you up with a uniform?
Well, they knew about everything you wanted. You went along to them and said, I've got to get this uniform commission. And they measured you up. The tailor came in once or twice and got you fitted out, and they knew exactly the number of things you wanted and what you had to have. The whole routine was laid down. And so I was then sent.
How did you afford it?
You were given a uniform allowance and you had your pay.
Did the uniform allowance cover the uniform?
Oh, well, yes, it did, just about. Just about. But Gives were very good about letting you owe money. And what you did with guillotines was quite simple. You made them an allotment from your pay. And if you made them an allotment of that much, then you could draw up to this much. So basically, guillotines, you didn't have to worry about it. Guillotines would wait for their money.
Was there any kind of final assessment before you were actually signed up as a sub-lieutenant?
Well, after you became a temporary acting sub-lieutenant, they were asked if you had any particular interest, which you'd like to specialise in anything particularly. And I said, yes, I was interested in navigation. And they said, right. And they sent me to Greenwich, Royal Naval College, for a fortnight. And that was a marvellous occasion, because it is a wonderful building, and I was extremely privileged, I still think, to have had a fortnight there. And there again, we did advanced navigation. And we did coding with a charming Wren officer who said, if anybody doesn't really understand it, I always prepare to stay late and help you. And then the trouble was everybody wanted to stay late, so there was not a point, was there? But you dined in the painted hall by candles with old retired pensioners acting as wardroom attendants, as the attendants there, Royal Marine attendants. You had your napkin in the rack. You went into the anteroom. You learned how to... What you were there for, basically, was to learn another thing, how to drink gin. How to drink, because you, in a wardroom, you had a ration. If it was a sub-lieutenant, you had a ration, I think, 10 shillings a week. Something like that. You didn't have very much. But when gin was tuppence a tot at sea, it didn't matter very much. But I go occasionally back to Greenwich, and it was an absolute marvellous experience. The
what do you mean, learning to drink gin, though? I mean, just to hold it, or so that you didn't get drunk on it, or...?
Oh, sir. To put in the right amount of Angostura in it, to make it pink. To have Coates gin and nothing else. There's some Coates gin over there. But, it's not so much learning how to drink, but how to learn to drink gin with senior officers, with commanders and lieutenant commanders, because most of the time, you see, officers, senior to yourself, were like gods. You didn't ever, as a rating, ever speak to them. If it led to lieutenant commander and above, you certainly wouldn't have spoken to them directly, unlikely to. But in a wardroom, of course, you in the end would be expected to know how to behave yourself in relation to your senior officers. And Greenwich was quite a good way of finding out. You know, you speak when you're spoken to on the whole, but you don't, not too much of a shrinking violet. It's a question of learning how to behave socially.
Now, did you pass as a navigational officer?
I did pass my test, and there was no qualification as such, but it was on my record, I suspect, that I'd done this course. And we had a marvellous drifter, which went up and down the Thames, called the Boy's Own, in charge of an R&R skipper, an old fisherman. And we would take charge of this drifter and guide it up and down the Thames by giving orders to the helmsman. And it is said that every time a tug saw that coming over the horizon, they would head for the shore and give us a fair wide berth. But Greenwich was fun. And from Greenwich...
Now, where are we up to now? You'd gone to King Alfred's in December 42... how long had the whole process taken?
Oh, I suppose altogether 6 months, perhaps, including Greenwich.
So yeah. We're through to June 43.
No, wait a minute. When did I?
December 42. So we're thinking it's about June 43. We just had a look at the date.
It was about June 43. Yes, absolutely.
And what happened then?
Well, I went on leave. I spent in Cheshire. And I was sent a telegram those report to my ship, HMS Duckworth, additional for watchkeeping. And to report first to HMS Asbury Park in a fortnight's time. Which was in America. And I had to kit myself out in the meantime with tropical uniform. So I ring up Gives in London and they say, no problem at all, sir. In a week's time we'll have a tin trunk on crew station for you to be picked up with everything you need. And there it was, everything I needed. And I went from there to Liverpool, went across by Queen Mary.
What do you remember of the voyage?
To New York, 4 days at sea. You ate twice a day. It was so crowded it wasn't true. Tens of thousands of people on board. And the catering was done on a 24-hour basis, and you were allocated two slots within that 24 hours where you fed. It could have been any time. There was no rational excuse. There's no reason why. You were given two slots 12 hours apart or something like that. And we got into New York,